welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, a Democratic gubernatorial debate between Senator Hollis French and Ethan Berkowitz. On August 24th, voters decide who will represent the Democrats in the race to be Alaska's next governor. Recorded on Thursday, August 5th, Commonwealth North hosted the debate at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage, whereupon retired Judge Karen Hunt served as moderator.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to Commonwealth North. I'm Karen Hunt, retired judge, past president, and current board member of Commonwealth North. Thank you for being here. Your presence brings about positive public discussion, such as takes place in these debates, and it is all discussion about the policy issues that we need to address, issues that need to be solved in order to create a prosperous Alaska for all Alaskans. Okay, now we're going to get to the day's program. First of all, you know that there are question cards on the table. So as you hear the candidates speak, if you have a question you want followed up on, then write out that question, hold it up, staff will pick it up. And then between Joe and I, the second hour of this debate will be the opportunity we have to ask the candidates your questions and get your questions answered. Now, during the first hour of the debate, here's what we're going to do. We have asked the candidates, and we've given them our statements and the questions, to address three areas of key public policy that are of interest to all Alaskans and especially to Commonwealth North: fiscal policy, energy, and health care. Each of the candidates will first have 5 minutes to answer the question. And then the other candidate will have 5 minutes, and then they will each have 3 minutes to make any response to the comments. As I said, during the second hour, we will get your questions answered. At this time, I am delighted to welcome the two Democratic candidates for governor to Commonwealth North's debate forum. Welcome, gentlemen. By this time, you probably know all of this, but let me just give you some highlights. Ethan Berkowitz, born in San Francisco, California, lived in Alaska for over 20 years. Berkowitz is an Alaskan business owner and has a master's degree in philosophy from the University of California. He was first elected to the Alaska House of Representatives in 1997 and served as House Minority Leader. Ethan is a former member of Commonwealth North and has worked extensively on energy issues in the legislature, including Alaska's first statewide renewable energy bill. Senator Hollis French. Senator Hollis French was born in Newton, Massachusetts, has lived in Alaska for over 30 years. He is a small business owner and served in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves. He was elected to the Alaska State Senate in 2002 and continues to serve as the chair of the Judiciary Committee. Hollis has worked extensively on ACES and on reforming Alaska's taxation policy. With that, let us begin. Fiscal policy. Commonwealth North has a long-standing commitment to long-term economic health of Alaska and to addressing the state's critical and continuing financial needs. We continue to support a long-range fiscal plan that can serve as a guide to determine whether any proposed budget level can be sustained. So the question to both candidates, and they're going to speak in order, reversing order, so the first one will be Senator French. And this is a long question, and it is a combination of two. How will you, if governor, develop a long-range fiscal plan for Alaska? What changes will you make in order to ensure a stable and predictable financial future for all Alaskans? Senator French, please.
Thank you, and let me just start by saying thank you very much to Commonwealth North for having us here today. It's a great opportunity for us to come before you to answer questions, and I particularly appreciate the long format, the longer answers. We've been in lots of debates where it's 30 seconds, 60 seconds, and it's hard to convey some of the more complex issues that face us in the state under those circumstances and those conditions. Let me start by saying you're going to hear two themes from me today over and over: renewable energy and education. Now, the next question is about energy, so I'll save my remarks about that until then. But I want to say a quick word about education and why it's so important to a long-range fiscal plan. Because if you look at the center of any strong economy worldwide, you'll find a powerful education system pumping out intelligent young graduates. And that's my long-term vision for the state. I want to just do a couple of more words about my biography, just to give you a better idea of who I am. I moved to Alaska in 1978. I went to work on an oil rig in Cook Inlet because I was looking for adventure, and I found it washing pots and pans, and worked my way up to being a production operator there, and wound up spending 13 years in the industry, 5 on the rig in Cook Inlet and 8 on the North Slope as a production operator. During my years on the slope, I finished on my days off an undergraduate degree at UAA, and then took that degree with me and went to law school at Cornell. Upon graduation, I joined the DA's office, started at the bottom again, and eventually wound up prosecuting robberies and homicides. I joined the Alaska State Senate in 2002. I've been there ever since. And I give you a little bit of the outline of my life because, in my view, my story is like the stories I hear as I go around the state. It's the story of you, of coming to Alaska looking for adventure, working hard, planning for the future, and getting real results. As I speak to you here today, apply this test. Ask yourself, has this person been able to bring his ideas down to earth and make them real? That's the test I ask you to apply. Now then, how do we develop a long-range fiscal plan? First of all, we focus on renewable energy and education, because that's the long-term vision. Take our oil revenue and invest in renewable energy to make certain that energy prices stay low. Sell our oil, sell our gas to somebody else, invest that in renewable energy. Invest in education. Make certain that we have a powerful education system pumping out intelligent young graduates. And keep a fair oil tax on the books to pay for that. I was in the legislature when ACES passed. I was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We listened very, very carefully to experts from both sides. We analyzed the evidence in open sessions, on the record, with the lights on. We listened to industry. We listened to others, we listened to experts from around the world, and we devised a fair tax based on profits, based on the idea that you can adjust this tax to each field because of the economics of the field. High-cost fields write off high costs. You don't pay a penny of tax until you make a profit. And on wildly profitable fields like Prudhoe Bay, the state gets a fair share. Let me tell you a quick story about my days on the oil rig. I went up to work on that rig in 1979, and the guys there were very, very proud of the fact that they'd been told when that rig was set in 1965 that it would only last 10 years. And they were all about, hey, look, we're 4 years past the drop-dead zone. We're still producing oil out here. Ladies and gentlemen, I went back there 2 years ago. It's still pumping oil 30 years later. Oil will be flowing out of the North Slope for the foreseeable future, as long as you're here and as long as I'm here, as long as we have intelligent young engineers. And I hope they come from UAF and UAA and UAS to continue to squeeze oil out of those wildly productive reservoirs. That's the idea. We talk a lot about ACES, and there's been a lot of talk about how destructive it's been of investment. But quick facts, since we passed ACES in 2007, employment is up on the North Slope. Since we passed ACES in 2007, capital investment is up. And since we passed ACES in 2007, the state has gotten a fair share of the oil wealth. In 2008, when oil prices hit $145 a barrel, the state put $5 billion into savings. Remember that old saying about how we shouldn't waste the next oil boom? We'll promise we won't waste it. We didn't. We saved it through bipartisan work in the Senate. The point of this is, to sum up, The long-range fiscal plan is keep a fair oil tax on the books. My time is up. Contain government growth and keep downward pressure on medical costs, which we'll discuss in question three. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
You can respond. It's okay. Thank you.
You know, I can't come and stand before this group without sharing a memory I have of Governor Hickel. It's about 20 years ago, when I was a young DA, Governor Hickel showed up in the office as my first day in the office, and I had to get sworn in. There was cameras there then, and we started looking around the office trying to find a Bible. We couldn't find a Bible in the DA's office. I don't know if that means anything in and of itself, but we couldn't find a Bible. But the show had to go on. And so, as it turns out, I swore in as a young district attorney on a copy of Governor Hickel's Who Owns America? Maybe that's why I have this view of Alaska as the owner state. Look, I remember $9 oil. I think most of us in this room do. I remember the havoc it created with the state's budget. I think the proudest accomplishment I had during the 10 years I served in Juneau was being part of the bipartisan fiscal policy caucus. It included luminaries like Lisa Murkowski and Andrew Halcrow, people whose names you know and those on the other side of the aisle. And we were able to do something that no one ever thought possible. We were able to unite Alaskans around a fiscal plan. Unfortunately, they united around the other side of the argument. 83% of Alaskans said they didn't like the fiscal plan we put forward. But that doesn't obviate the need for a long-range fiscal plan. And the things I learned going through the process at that time are as true today as they were then. We cannot continue to squander our oil wealth on annual budgets. And I can talk to you about downward pressures on the state budget. I can talk to you about sustainability. I can talk to you about predictability. But until you have the structure in place that inhibits the ability of the legislature and the governor to spend money, they're going to spend the money. Because people who are elected have a different currency than people who operate in business. And the currency in politics is votes. And you get votes by buying projects. And that's got to change. And the idea that I've had builds around the genius of the permanent fund. And the genius of the permanent fund is that you take a non-renewable resource and you convert it into something renewable. Now, we do that for 50% of oil royalties on new fields, 25% on old fields. We don't do that for the other portion of royalties, and we don't do it for the severance component of the state's oil revenue. Just a quick digression here. There are two pieces of the state's oil wealth. There's the royalty, which is the state's share, and there's the severance, which is now known as ACES. It had been PPT. It was ELF before that. That wealth goes into the state's annual budget. So, in essence, we're stealing from future generations. There's a question of intergenerational equity. There's no reason why oil that's been cooking in the ground for millions of years should be spent to sustain this year's budget and deprive the next generation of the benefits of that. So what I'd like to see happen is that we put all of our oil wealth into some kind of account. Instead of spending it first, we save it first before we start to spend it. Now, there's various prior incarnations of this idea. Some of you might remember Roger Cremo had an idea that was comparable to this, percent of market value. But there's nothing inherently new about the idea of preserving that oil wealth for the future. And that's how you contain, how you create a long-range fiscal plan. Because until there's a long-range fiscal plan, Alaska's going to have a very unstable investment climate. And it's unstable because we're so oil dependent that industry knows that if the state goes through a shortfall, there's essentially only one place to go to get revenue, and that's the industry. There's not enough personal taxes available in the state to balance a budget. That's not going to happen. And so it's only through the state's oil wealth that we can create a long-range fiscal plan. And once we have a long-range fiscal plan, we'll be in a stronger negotiating position. We'll be able to say, we have the rainy day accounts in place. We're able to sustain tough times. We're preserving our wealth for future generations. And it's in that long-range fiscal plan that Alaska's economic future depends. And we get to that long-range fiscal plan by preserving our wealth and protecting that wealth. And that's something we need to do. And it's not something that's been talked about. It's something that gets lost in the discussion of what kind of tax are we going to have instead of how do we save the money for the future.
$12 billion in savings. That's real money. sitting in the bank when oil prices go down or production goes down. We have looked to the future. We can contain the growth of government. You can keep downward pressure on headcount. One thing I wanted to mention was that there are ways to enhance the use of the internet, of web-based services. The state government is far, far behind you and the private sector when it comes to adopting the usage of the internet and providing services across Alaska. You can do it with broadband. You can do it with Skype. You can do it with innovative ways. So there are ways to save money in state government, and I'd be happy to talk to you. I'm sorry, was it time? No? Okay, very good.
Mr. Berkowitz?
And I've always said it's good that $12 billion was saved. I've always said that the economic limit factor was broken, that we needed to do something different. This isn't a question about securing revenue for today. It's about securing wealth for the future. That's what we need to do. The structure in place doesn't do that. The structure in place depends upon the legislators and the governor who are sitting there today. That's not the kind of institutional safeguards we need for our wealth. That's not what we need. That's not what I've been discussing at all when I try and talk about the need for a long-range fiscal plan. You know, and we're always going to have discussion about this great way of saving money, but we're not going to save the kind of money the state needs through the internet or through broadband, and I've worked on broadband projects. You prevent the state from spending too much money by not putting too much money into the state's hands at any one time. And you can do that through a percent of market value system. I mean, there is logic to that. It doesn't tell the legislature what it has to spend on any given year for any given program. And of course, it's going to take a transition before we can move completely to a system like that. Of course it does. Nothing's going to happen overnight. But you've got to have some long-range goals. We can't just go year to year, budget to budget, trying to say, this year we took care of education. We don't know what's going to happen next year. This year we did infrastructure, but we don't know how we're going to pay for operations and maintenance into the future. You need structures in place that guide the legislature as it goes through the annual debate. It doesn't take away from the ability of every legislature every year to make determinations about how to spend the state's accounts. That's not what I'm talking about doing. I'm talking about protecting the wealth that goes beyond today and goes into the future. That's what we have to do. If we just continue to focus on what's going to happen tomorrow in Alaska, that's all we're going to see. We've got to lift our heads up again and start looking more to the future. We've got to put the plans in place that allow future generations to have more opportunities. You know, my wife and I, we have two kids, and there's probably nothing as life-changing as having kids, because instead of worrying simply about what's going to happen in the immediate future, you take a longer-term view. I want my kids to have opportunities here. I want the economy to be strong here. But until we recognize that it's oil wealth that protects our economy, that's built our economy, that provides a foundation for our economy, we're going to be in trouble because we can't squander that wealth. I want to protect that wealth so there is going to be a future. I want to build on it because Alaska has a lot still to do, a lot still to offer.
If you haven't already pinned a question, take a moment, grab a card, write it down, hold it up. We're now going to switch the topic, and we're going to talk about energy. One strong example of Commonwealth North's impact on energy policy in Alaska is a recent initiative by the Board of Directors which created an Energy Action Coalition. The purpose of that coalition is to implement recommendations that were made in past Commonwealth North energy studies, including the one we just issued in 2010, Energy for a Sustainable Alaska, the Rail Belt Predicament. This group continues to meet, it hears speakers, it evaluates report recommendations, it facilitates dialogue regarding energy policy throughout the state of Alaska. So to these two candidates, Commonwealth North poses the following questions. What is Alaska's top energy problem that you're going to solve in your term as governor, and how do you plan to solve that problem? Second part of that question is, how do you propose to pay for that solution? Will we begin now with Mr. Berkowitz?
And I suspect we're going to say a lot of the same things here. You know, I see a day 50 years in the future where every building is energy self-sufficient, where every village is producing the energy it needs. And you've got to have that kind of vision. And I've been impressed to see strides made towards renewable energy in Alaska, towards making sure that the villages are sustainable, that the rail belt has some energy. But a look at the opportunities that have been squandered. 2-3 years ago, we all got an energy rebate. $750 million was spent in Juneau. $750 million. Uncle Sam was the biggest beneficiary. That was income tax to him. And we didn't do one thing to change how we produce or distribute energy with that. And I look at the 100 villages across this state that pay $5, $6, $7, $8 a gallon, and I see those 100 villages, and if they had had wind turbines put into those villages, they'd have been able to contain the cost of their energy. And wind's not going to work everywhere. But when you're paying 60 or 80 cents a kilowatt hour and you can produce your own energy for 15 or 20 cents, it makes a huge difference. And I say this having worked on renewable energy projects in the lower Yukon, Kuskokwim, and across Western Alaska. We can do this. And the simple truth is every time somebody imports a dollar's worth of diesel, they're exporting a dollar and they're exporting a job. That's not good enough for Alaska. We've got to keep our resources here. We've got 90% of America's tidal potential, and we aren't really utilizing any of it. We ought to be on the cutting edge of research as far as tidal goes, so when the rest of the world catches up to our knowledge, they come seeking our intellectual property. Our people go to work for it. You look at what's gone on in Iceland. Iceland is the capital of geothermal energy, and people from Iceland travel the world promoting Iceland and the expertise that they've had. We've got geothermal energy here. Mount Spur, 150 megawatts of power just sitting there. So we have huge potential. What we don't have is leadership. We don't have the kind of commitment to renewable energy from the governor's office. And we definitely need more refining capacity. I want to see gas to liquids come into place. I want to see us try and develop fuels here. But we need some leadership. And that's been chronically missing for far too long. Far too long. Alaskans have unique capacity in terms of the energy that's available to us. I describe us as the Saudi Arabia of renewable energy. And we've squandered opportunity time and again. All that beetle-killed spruce, that's biomass. That's just dying there, doing nothing. We could have produced energy with it. We could have made for healthier forests if we'd been aggressive in our approach. But you've got to have a sense of where you want to go in terms of energy. That's really critical. Really, really critical. You know, you look at the rail belt situation, folks wring their hands about, we're running out of gas. Well, we are running out of gas. But we have renewables here. The peak rail belt energy consumption is about 800 megawatts. You've got 75 megawatts of wind at Fire Island, 75 megawatts at Eva Creek. You've got 150 megawatts of geothermal at Mount Spur. You've got 300, 350 megawatts of power coming off of Chacachamna Hydro. That's a serious chunk of the rail belt's energy demand. And if we had gotten on the program 5 years ago or 10 years ago, we would have supplanted our demand for gas from Cook Inlet gas with local renewables. And we would have been able to do things like keep Agrium open, keep the jobs that are available there, and export the value of our hydrocarbons, meanwhile producing low-cost, affordable energy for Alaskans. It's a question of direction. And the question I've been submitting time and again during the course of this campaign is, we just cannot keep doing what we've been doing. It's not good enough. It's not good enough for what Alaska's all about. It's not good enough for providing the self-sufficiency and the jobs that the state desperately needs. You can't have a governor who sits in Juneau and does nothing. Because if you do nothing, you'll get nothing. And Alaska cannot tolerate standing still when the rest of the world is moving ahead.
Alaska's top energy problem is the cost of energy. There's no question about it. The cost of energy is hurting families. It's hurting businesses. You leave Anchorage and go to Fairbanks. It's painful there. Painful. $1,000 a month to heat your home. Leave Fairbanks and go to Ruby or Tanana or Kotzebue or Nome. And the cost of energy is crushing the economic life out of large swaths of Alaska. We have got to do something. There is no question about it. We've made some progress. We've put PCE on a permanent footing to make certain that people can heat their homes and keep their lights on in rural Alaska. We've also invested largely and heavily in home weatherization, simple ideas that make sure that you save a gallon of diesel, save a barrel of oil before you use it. And we did the same thing this year by establishing a statewide energy policy. You know, in the crush of business at the end of the session, you sometimes wonder how it came out. And I was walking down the street in Juneau and I saw Chris Rose, one of the state's leaders in renewable energy. And I said, how do we do this year? And he talked about the omnibus energy bill that came out of the Senate Resources Committee, of which I am a member. And he said, you guys did good work. You guys did a great job. You put something on the books the state has been lacking for a long, long time, and that's a vision for energy policy. And I was happy to hear that he was endorsing what we had done. What's the big picture, though? The big picture remains the gas pipeline, a natural gas pipeline carrying the vast resources of the North Slope to market. I subscribe to the Costco theory of gas pipelines, which is build the biggest one possible, right? Build a big pipe, move a lot of gas, because the economics of gas, as you know, are not as robust as the economics of oil. You've got to move a lot. And AGEA is getting us there. I was proud to be a part of the debate, proud to be a part of the process. And when we voted on AGEA on the floor, I said this: we are, to a large degree, in the oil and gas business as the state. And we are making an investment today, an investment, a big one, in what amounts to a well we're drilling. We may hit dust, but we may hit a gas pipeline. And if we hit a gas pipeline, it's going to return a fair economic value to you and you and you, and moreover, not only to you in this room, but all around the state. To Ketchikan, to Kodiak, to Kotzebue, they get a fair share of that resource. They get a fair share of that wealth. That's the idea. You've got to pay attention to the economic terms. You know, the people forget that it only took about 24 months of construction to build the oil pipeline. It'll take about 24 months of construction to build the natural gas pipeline. And then what? 50 years of economic terms, 50 years of making certain that we get a fair return for that so we can continue to invest in renewable energy, so we can continue to invest in education, the mainstays of our future. That's the idea. You know, I went out to Ruby last year as a member of the Resources Committee, and we took a look at the in-river hydro project they had there. It's fascinating. They are experimenting with ideas, small targeted solutions for each location in the state that will solve their energy problems. In Tanana, they're burning wood. The circles come all the way back around. The energy solution for Tanana is in a super efficient wood-fired boiler that circulates hot water to the washateria there that keeps it open and keeps it available as a community center. That's the long-term vision. Small targeted solutions for parts of Alaska and a big natural gas pipeline carrying huge volumes of gas to market. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And you know what's going to happen, and I do, because the resource is too rich. Our political climate is too stable, and the market continues to grow for clean energy in the lower 48. That's the long-term vision. Thank you.
Gentlemen, as you take an opportunity to respond, may I remind you of the second half of that question, which is, you've both put good ideas out on the table. Now, would you address how it is that you would suggest we pay to develop refining, wind, biomass, and do we need to do more when it comes to AGEA? Thank you.
You saved the hardest part for last. Look, the business model that I put forward when I was trying to do wind development in Western Alaska was essentially we'd go to a community and say, let us put up a turbine here. We'll take the displaced diesel cost for a certain period of time, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, and after that period of time, the turbine is yours. That's how you pay for it. You pay for it by allowing the amortization to take place with the cost of displaced diesel. And the markets exist if you want to do that. You do it with revenue bonds. You do it by not squandering the resources that the state has available to it.
We've got a lot of funds that go towards subsidizing energy in Alaska, the power cost equalization, PCE. I mean, nobody flips a light switch in Alaska without having a piece of that power paid for by the state government. Nobody. But we don't do a good job in terms of making sure that those investments pay for themselves. And we got to do that. We have the ability to change the energy infrastructure of this state, and we've got to be aggressive about it. You pay for it. You pay for it with the costs that are avoided. You pay for it with bonds. You pay for it with capital appropriations. But you have to do it in a stable and predictable way. Because the experience I had in private business was you'd go to a community and they say, we're not interested in taking that kind of private business deal at this point because there's a possibility. There's a possibility we might get the money for free. There could be a state grant. So there are two structural things that I learned from that experience that have to change. First of all, independent power producers have to know what the rules are. And those rules are not clear right now. And the second thing that has to be clear is what the state energy funding streams look like. Because until you know what the funding streams look like, it's a huge disincentive for investment. And private people will stay away. There is a lot of money lining up and ready to come play in renewable energy. A lot of money. We ought to be bringing it here. We can bring it here. I'm sure I'll get a chance to discuss gas pipeline at some future point during this conversation, because I know it's critical to everybody in this room. It seems to drive much of the debate during this campaign, and I look forward to that aspect of it. But I wanted to clarify that we've got to have a good investment climate in Alaska if we're going to have renewable development.
I think a direct answer to the question is you keep a fair oil tax on the books. That's how you pay for it. Keep a fair oil tax on the books. Continue to save money while we are banking, while we are making it. The $12 billion in the Constitutional Budget Reserve is a way you continue to pay for projects long into the future. That's how you pay for it. Once you get yourself into a position where you can bring your natural gas to market, having paid close attention to the tariff, you'll be fine. But it's important to watch those pennies, as you know. Had we done the oil pipeline right, the state would have been in a better shape. We would have gotten a more fair share of that oil pipeline. You know, we saw profits recently, just this week from Conoco. Conoco reports their Alaska profits, and I respect them for doing that. I appreciate it. And their profits remain strong. The company's doing well in Alaska. We're getting a fair share of that wealth, and we're banking it. So the short answer is keep a fair oil tax on the books. The long answer is keep a fair oil tax on the books. Continue to invest in renewable energy. Continue to invest in education. And that's how you pay for things going into the future. You educate a bright young class of Alaskans to solve the problems that they're going to encounter in 10 or 20 years. It's hard to predict the future. You know, one of the things I suggested this year in the Senate was to have a catastrophe day in the Finance Committee to explore exactly what you do if oil prices hit $20 and stay there, to take a hard look at the budget to make certain that you're squeezing every dollar out if you get to that point. And you need to game that future out, because you don't know what the oil prices are going to be, and I don't either. I wish I did, but they'll surprise you every time when you think you know which direction they're going. Maybe they'll go back up, maybe they'll go back down, I don't know. But for the time being, we've got $12 billion in savings through good stewardship, through producing real results, through bringing our ideas down to earth and making them real, and that's what you keep doing into the future. That's what I'll do as governor. Thank you.
If you have a question, you haven't written it, please grab a card, write it down now. Third topic, healthcare. Commonwealth North has been a leader in researching, coordinating, and implementing healthcare public policies in Alaska. The Board of Directors created our Health Care Action Coalition to support recommendations that had been made by an earlier Commonwealth group known as the Alaska Health Care Roundtable. And that group resulted from a 2005 study group entitled Alaska Primary Health Care: Opportunities and Challenges. Over the past year and a half, the coalition has helped promote and to pass legislation to support, first, the establishment of electronic medical records to improve safety, efficiency, and quality of health care throughout Alaska. Another bill that Commonwealth North was involved in is establishing the ongoing Alaska Health Care Commission to develop a statewide plan to address the quality, the accessibility, and the availability of health care for all Alaskans, wherever they may live. So we have a question, gentlemen. Alaska has the highest health care cost in the nation. What will you do to reduce health care costs for Alaskans and for Alaska's budget without reducing the quality of current care and hopefully improving the future of health care in Alaska? And now, of course, I'm going to call on the wrong gentleman, so whoever's supposed to go next, please do. Thank you.
No, thank you. You know, a quick story. At the end of the 2007 oil tax debate, it was a big, big deal. And when that bill was finished, I was sitting in my office with my chief of staff, Cindy Smith, and she looked at me and she said, okay, we've reformed oil taxes, what now? And I said, perhaps out of an abundance of optimism, healthcare reform. And I began a quest then with the help of a person who's put enormous amounts of work into this, and he's sitting at the back table, Andy Motoro. If you haven't met him, you should, because I hired him and we began to work on crafting a long-term solution to Alaska's healthcare problems. We began to craft a solution that would cover every single Alaskan with affordable health insurance. And that was a quest that we began and we pushed it. We created a website. I spoke to hundreds of groups. We wrote compass pieces. We pushed the word out that there is a way to create a business-friendly healthcare reform effort that will lower your costs of doing business, keep employees at your business, and make them healthier. We realized as we worked into this that prevention is crucial. Prevention is absolutely number one. That's how you save medical costs, through public health efforts, through making sure that you're attacking obesity, through making sure that you continue to keep downward pressure on smoking rates, to make sure that young people make healthy choices when they reach for something to eat after lunch. These little things seem natural to you and to me, but many, many families don't know this. And government has a role in showing how you can live right, save money, and prevent healthcare costs from going up. We should also continue to cover children with health insurance and pregnant women. I was stunned and amazed when this governor vetoed the increase we put to Denali kid care this year. Absolutely floored. It was the wrong thing to do. I went to the Senate in 2003, and that year was the year in a bitter debate. Frank Murkowski and the Republicans there pushed through a freeze on Denali kid care eligibility levels, effectively putting us at the bottom of the nation as the way we treat children and pregnant women. And we fought and fought and fought, and through the work of the coalition, through the bipartisan coalition, Senator Betty Davis was able to get her bill through raising those eligibility rates with the help of the governor, who suddenly decided after the session was over to veto the bill. It was wrong. I've spoken out against it. So is Ethan Berkowitz. And we're both right. And this governor is flat wrong on this. And I'm going to fix that if I become governor. I'm going to begin that the first day I get into office, is to restore Denali kid care to 1,200 children and pregnant women around the state. I feel very strongly about that. We also have taken aim at Medicare reimbursement rates, which is something that's long plagued primary care patients here in Anchorage. When you go onto Medicare, you can't find a doctor because your rates are too high. The reimbursement rates are too low, I'm sorry, and what you get back from Medicare is insufficient to cover the cost of your visit. This year, Senator Mark Begich, working with Les Guerra, Lindsey Holmes, and others, was able to insert into the United States a healthcare bill that passed a provision allowing for the first time ever for us to supplement our Medicare reimbursement rates through grants. We're going to go to work on that next year. That's an exciting development. There are also developments coming to us from Providence in the creation of Medicare clinics, a place where you can get Medicare reimbursement rates at a higher rate in that clinic than in a standalone doctor's office. That's an exciting development that will allow our senior citizens to stay here, to be healthier because they can find a primary care doctor, and reduce the overall cost of medical care. I'm particularly thankful for the work that Commonwealth North has done on the subject. They have been leaders in the subject. They've sponsored roundtables. They've published papers. It's an extremely important topic. It's complex. I've been working on it for years. I'm excited about what we can do in the future, working together to make Alaskans healthier. Thank you.
You know, everybody's touched by the healthcare debate in one form or another. And the challenge in Alaska isn't simply about affordable care. It's also a question of access to care. We can talk about Anchorage being 40% more expensive than Seattle, but you go out to the village, or a village, and there's no health care. We can talk about the virtues of electronic records keeping, and I'm proud of the fact that when I was in the legislature, I had the first amendments that encouraged the state to seek electronic records keeping funds. But until you have broadband infrastructure, it's no good. I've talked to people in Dillingham who say, yeah, that electronic records keeping stuff, that's great. It takes me 23 hours to download it. That's not going to get the job done. What we need to have in this state is our own system that's unique to our own set of circumstances. Because the healthcare solution that works in Washington, D.C. isn't going to be the one that works in Alaska. And what works in Anchorage isn't going to work in Fairbanks or Juneau or Bethel or in one of the villages. We need to be able to have a healthcare system that works for all of us. We need to have a healthcare system so that people who need healthcare can get it and those who provide it get paid. That's what healthcare should do. And I've heard Sean Parnell say no to Denali Kid Care, no to letting kids stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. Well, no is not a health care plan. I'll give you a good Republican health care plan that we ought to be pursuing, at the very least. Let people buy insurance over state lines. Let small businesses pool together. Allow for supplemental payment. Let's start growing our own doctors and nurses here. Why aren't we doing that? Because there's no leadership. Doing nothing is not leadership. So, we need to do a lot better in terms of delivering the healthcare that Alaska needs. We lead the country tragically in what I call the metrics of despair. Pregnancies that aren't going to term. We lead in terms of suicides and alcoholism. And all the social tragedies that don't get much attention during a political campaign. And we do it because there's no leadership, and we don't involve those kind of conditions in the discussion about health care. And those are tragedies that are preventable. And wellness and prevention, that's part of the solution. But we need some real leadership. Because until real leadership exists, there are real people out there who aren't getting the health care that they need. And I can sit here and quote statistics as much as anyone else can. But healthcare is ultimately about people. And there's something incredibly antiseptic when the entire debate about healthcare is waged in terms of statistics. It's about the little kid who can't get glasses. It's about the parent who has to choose whether they're going to keep their job and not get Denali Kid Care or provide treatment for their child. These are real stories that happen all around us in Alaska. It's about alcoholism in the villages. It's about the failure to treat people when they're incarcerated here. These are real people. These are our neighbors. These are our friends, and these are our family. And until we humanize this debate, we're not going to win it. And that's what has to get done. And there's all kinds of good policy solutions out there. But let's do them. I'm sick and tired of looking at studies that sit on shelves because there's no leadership to just get the job done. And that's what has to change.
Let's have a quick little interaction here. Everybody here who has a health insurance policy, please raise your hand. Everybody who doesn't. It's not 15%, help is on the way. Okay, help is on the way. If we can get 15% of Alaskans don't have a health insurance policy. Over 100,000 Alaskans woke up this morning without a health insurance policy. And that's risky. It's risky for them, it's risky for their families. The effort I began has been completed by the National Congress. This governor is suing to stop it, suing to stop a plan to cover Alaskans with a health insurance policy. That infuriates me also. It really does. It's the wrong thing to do. This is the most business-friendly solution to the health care crisis of insurance that you can imagine. It is essentially, if you haven't followed the debate very carefully, subsidized private insurance. It is not complex. It's a good idea. It makes insurance affordable to people who don't otherwise have access to a health insurance policy. And it helps small businesses by keeping your employees there. Keeping their employees there and not having them run to the state or run to ConocoPhillips or run to a big employer that offers health insurance policy. They can stay in their jobs and thrive. They can stay in their jobs and go see a doctor. I would not be wasting state resources suing to stop something that's a good idea. Someday we will look back on this era and wonder what in the heck were we doing trying to stop the delivery of health insurance to Americans and to Alaskans. There'd be a different approach taken if I were governor. Thank you.
I've got two stories that are sticking in my mind right now. One is the veterans who have to go outside to get medical care because the bureaucracy won't let them get medical care here in state. That's absurd. That's an absurd, expensive solution that dehumanizes the veteran, dehumanizes his family or her family, and deprives that family of the ability to be with their loved one when care is being provided. It also inhibits the ability of healthcare providers in this state to have access to the funding streams that come from the VA. We've got to break down that ridiculous barrier. We've also got to build the kind of infrastructure so we can provide healthcare. Now, I was downstairs in this hotel several months back making a presentation about a fiber optic project I'm working on. We described in glowing terms what the advantages of broadband are, and there was a man in the back of the room who came up to me afterwards, and he began weeping, and it was very powerful. He said, if we'd had this broadband, my grandson would be alive today, because we could have diagnosed him. We could have taken care of him, and he would have been alive today. So, we need to do something. That's what the call to arms is in this election, is doing something. Enough studying, time to do.
Okay, that brings us to the end of the first hour of our time with these candidates.
You're listening to a Democratic gubernatorial debate between Senator Hollis French and Ethan Berkowitz on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. Recorded on Thursday, August 5th at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage, the debate was hosted by Commonwealth North and moderated by retired Judge Karen Hunt, who posed questions submitted by audience members in the second half of the program.
What I'm going to do first is some of the questions that have come in are addressed to the individual candidates. And I want to give them an opportunity to either explain what they meant by what they said or to respond to a question that's directly related to something they said. So I'm going to start with Mr. Berkowitz. Mr. Berkowitz, how do you propose to fund state government if all oil revenue goes into the permanent fund? I'm not sure that's what you told us, but perhaps you'd like to clarify that.
I propose to fund state government from the stream of revenue that comes out of a permanent account. That's what I propose to do. And I've also been pretty clear, at least I'm clear in my mind, apparently not clear enough for public purposes, about saying that we can't get there overnight. It's going to take a period of transition before you can take the current revenues and put them into the fund. And I just firmly believe that if the principle is with the permanent fund that you're making sure that non-renewable resource wealth becomes renewable, if you believe in intergenerational equity, that we've got to make sure that we're not spending the money from this year's oil revenue without at least putting it into an account, stabilizing it, and taking the revenue from that account and funding state government.
But that account is not the permanent fund dividend account. That's a separate...
But there is no permanent fund dividend account.
Well,
there's the principal and the earnings account. And there's sub-accounts within the permanent fund. And we need to build them up. There have been proposals in the past year in the legislature to put all of the state's accounts together and add them up and use the stream of income from them to start funding state government. And there's merit to those proposals. But there's a period of transition that comes with a move to a more stable fiscal system. And that's what has to happen. But if we're afraid to have the debate about how we're going to get where we need to go, we're not going to go anywhere.
Okay, while you're there,
okay.
Clarification question. Is the phrase percent of market value your code for doing something about the permanent fund dividend?
No.
Okay. And what was it that you applied POMV to?
Well, the percent of market value, I said that there are precursors to what I've described in the history books, and the percent of market value was the idea that you're going to take a percent of an earning of a savings account, and a percent of that account is used to generate earnings, and those earnings go to pay for something. I mean, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's a fiscal term of art.
Okay, thank you. Senator French, two questions, clarification for you. How do you propose to continue generating oil revenue when oil production on the North Slope is declining 6 to 10% per year? At that rate, it seems that the pipeline will need to be shut down within the next 10 years and not be around for my children and my children's children.
The production, every oil field declines. I wish that were not true. It seems to be true. If you can find an oil field that continues to increase production year over year, you've found a magical goose that continues to lay golden eggs. Every oil field declines. You need to manage the rate of that decline. But I worked at Kuparuk, the second largest oil field in North America. I spent 8 years of my life there. And when we began to reform oil taxes in 2006 and 2007, the severance tax, the production tax at Kuparuk, was nearing zero. There are more, and so the point of that is that there are more things than the tax rate that affects investment. Because I can tell you that Kuparuk was not being invested in at the rate that I think is right, or you might think is right. They were not spending millions and millions and millions of dollars at Kuparuk with a 0% production tax. Why? Because oil prices were low. Oil prices have an effect on investment. You might be surprised to learn that. So you can keep production high. ACES, there's plenty of reason to keep investing on the North Slope. The oil industry is making plenty of money on their investments, and they don't want to see the decline happen any faster than you or I do. And intelligent young graduates, I hope from our schools, will crack the WestSAC code. They will crack the difficult reservoirs up there. They'll continue to find inventive new ways to squeeze those wildly productive reservoirs for as long as you and I are here in Alaska. That's my belief.
Okay, thank you. Both of you, your bios each include reference to an ownership of small business. What is the name of your business? Is it successful? And how will you manage it while you are governor? And we'll start with you since you're there.
My wife and I invested in an apartment building. When I went, my wife, she was already a real estate investor. And in 1989, we bought an apartment building in Fairview off Nelchina Street. And we began to remodel the apartments, and we began to rent them. And I keep the books, and we rent the apartments, and we meet the plumber, and we painted and hauled carpet and done all the things that small landlords do. 10 years ago, we bought a bigger apartment building, a 24-unit apartment building in Turnagain, one of the greatest buildings in town. I love this place. It's in a great location. Come see me someday if you need an apartment. And again, I keep the books. We meet the renters. We have a handyman who helps us. But we own and operate French Apartments. We've done so for 20 years. It's made a profit for every year. And I'm extremely proud of that because it's a mom-and-pop business like many of the businesses you own. Thank you.
Okay. This is a question. Mr. Bergwitt, you may start. No, that was a question to Mr. French. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was to both of you.
Huh.
Now I don't even know what the question is.
It's okay. Which small businesses do I have? I'm a part owner in two restaurants, Snow City Cafe, Great breakfast all day, go down, enjoy. Spinard Roadhouse, excellent bourbon tasting, make a trip there, and terrific food. I've also got a commercial building that I own, and I have other people manage for me. I was concerned when I was in the legislature about developing conflicts of interest, so I kept an arm's length with that. It's over on 8th or 9th and H Street. And I didn't know what to do with my own sort of consulting that I do, the advice that I provide for people's strategic development, so I just set something up myself. And primarily I've been working on this broadband initiative, trying to wrap a fiber optic cable around Western Alaska and running it to Japan and to Britain.
Okay, stay there. You can start with the next question if you would. Democratic candidates for governor. The last time we had a Democratic governor, he pushed North Star and Alpine to increase throughput into TAPS. What actions will you take to spur investment in oil, in gas, and a lot of questions ask about other industries?
How much time do I have?
Three.
Okay. You know, I've put forward a proposal to do our oil revenue system differently. One of the component pieces of the package is that we negotiate leases on a field-by-field or region-by-region basis. And people say, oh, that's a radical departure from the way we do things now. But I look at some of the legislation that's pending. There's legislation to change how ACES works for Cook Inlet gas, and I'm sure there'll be something for heavy oil in the future. There's already provision under existing statutes for leaseholders to apply for royalty relief on a field-by-field basis, subject to all kinds of statutory requirements. That's the kind of thing I envision, because if we can customize our oil revenue system according to the geology and the economics of individual fields, of individual developments, I think we can do a better job spurring development than we can under a one-size-fits-all tax structure. That's my view on it. There's a lot of development that we can and should be doing in this state. There's heavy oil, there's NPRA, there's offshore when conditions are right again. There's Nenana Basin, there's Cook Inlet. There's all kinds of opportunities around this state. There's renewable energy development that we can and should be doing. There are logistic opportunities. There's opportunities as the Arctic opens up in terms of shipping, in terms of being on the leading edge of research for what changes are occurring in the climate. There are plenty of economic opportunities in this state, but you got to have the kind of conditions that allow us to take advantage of those opportunities. And you also have to have the kind of aggressive leadership that goes out and finds those opportunities or opens the door if it's just cracked open a little bit today. So that's what I'd like to see doing differently. If there was more specifics in the question, I'm happy to stick around afterwards and deal with the specifics.
Okay, I want to stay there a moment because I want to ask you two questions that came up around this same question, which is, okay, lots of opportunity. You're now governor. Are you going to use the tax code? Are you going to use direct grants? How are you going to put out for the state of Alaska to investors incentives to invest in the things that you've enumerated? And then, Mr. French, I'll ask you, Senator, if you'll answer that question.
I'm going to use every single tool at my disposal to do it. And that's what we need to do. But we've got to be able to think beyond the systems that we have today. And I think if people are prisoners of existing systems, that doesn't allow the kind of imaginative responses that we need to succeed in a changing world. And one of the concerns I have about people who say, oh, no, we can't tinker with anything, we can't change even something that's good, is we don't live in a static universe. Things are changing all the time. The rest of the world is moving. And if Alaska is going to be competitive, we have to change along with it. But we need to change according to our own pace, according to our own what we feel is in our own best interest. And far too often in this state's history, we have been too dependent on outside interests telling us what's acceptable for us to do and when we can do it. We need to be much more in charge of our own future than we have been. And that requires active leadership, and we just haven't seen it from Sean Parnell.
Okay, Mr. Senator French, your response to those questions?
The tax debate that we're beginning to have between my opponent and me is a clear, sharp, real difference in these two campaigns. ACES is working. ACES adjusts to the economics of each field. You don't lock in a royalty rate through negotiation with the oil industry field by field by field when you're overwhelmed by a person across the table that has far more knowledge and the ultimate investment decision. You'll get captured, you'll get gamed, you'll get less. It's a bad idea. Keep aces on the books. It has enormous exploration credits. Talk to the nimble, smaller players who are excited about using those, who are applying for them, who are turning them into cash every year to finance their next year's exploration. It's working. It's a good idea. And you can tinker with it. We have tinkered with it since we passed it. But the basic structure is sound. It's a profits-based system. It took many of us a long time to get there, to come away from the gross, to come away from counting barrels and multiplying it times a number. But when oil prices hit $145 a barrel and the profits are skyrocketing, the state deserves to grab a fair share of that and to save it, just like we did in 2008. I hope we continue to see oil and gas development in Cook Inlet, on the North Slope, in new fields. I like oil development. I've been covered in oil, ladies and gentlemen. I know something about the oil industry from a hands-on perspective. And we will be producing oil and gas in the state for as long as you and I are here. The idea, though, is to invest now while we have the resources in renewable energy and education. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yes, and then Mr. French, you may have another word.
I'm really just a recovering lawyer. I haven't practiced in a long time, but I've always wanted to be in her courtroom again. So, you know, one of the advantages of going to a royalty is contract-based. And the advantage of contract is if you want to have fiscal certainty, you do it in contract. And if for some reason people decide we're going to just take ACEs and make that the contract, it's better than keeping something enshrined in legislation because it provides fiscal certainty. You can have reopeners in any kind of contract if you want. You can have all kinds of provisions in there to change terms as things move along. But my time in the legislature was bracketed by two big events. The first was $9 oil, and the second was corruption. And the more we can do to insulate corruption or prevent corruption from taking root in the legislature, from bad decisions from taking root in the dead of night by hurried amendments, the better off we're going to be. Because ACEs exist today, and I'll take Hollis's word on it that it's working just fine. But there are modifications coming. They're going to come, and they're not all going to be to his liking. They're not all going to be benign. But if you have something in contract when people have negotiated, professionals have negotiated, the legislature want to give thumbs up, thumbs down, and additional checks and balance, that's fine. But let's make sure that the process has integrity. Let's make sure we provide fiscal certainty, because we can't do it under current conditions. We can't do it if the state doesn't have a long-range fiscal plan, because next time the state gets short of money, it's only got one pocket to go to. Well, two, but it'll never touch the permanent fund. So the only pocket is oil.
Mr. French, do you want to say a last word? Okay. You have all talked about, you have both talked about developing other energy resources, but nobody's talked about mining and fishing and the other economic possibilities and industries that exist here. Where do any of those things fit into your economic vision of Alaska?
Great question.
Wasn't mine. Thank you, whoever did it.
Who wrote that? Great question. We should have a vibrant fishing industry. We should have a vibrant mining industry. In some places, they don't go together. And I've been clear from the beginning that I don't think that Pebble Mine is the place to put those two together. It's too risky. It threatens fish all over Alaska. I was in Sitka talking to fishermen there. And the Sitka fishermen say, don't do Pebble. Why? Because a drop of cyanide in Bristol Bay that makes Alaskan fish poisoned threatens our income in Southeast. It means all Alaskan fish are tainted. Don't do it in Bristol Bay. Don't risk our livelihoods in Sitka with that development. Fish is the ultimate renewable resource, and I love to eat salmon, and we want to see salmon coming back up the rivers forever. So there'll be a great fishing industry in Alaska as long as we continue to make improvements in icing the fish, in handling the fish, in making the fish get to market better. Those are all exciting things that you and private industry can do. Don't build a fish plant in South Anchorage. I wasn't in the legislature when that bright idea came along and got passed, and I'm glad I wasn't, because as I drive past it and look at that economic hole in the ground, I get a lesson about government putting too heavy of a thumb on the economy. Our business is to create a space in which you can work with intelligent graduates, with low-cost energy, and with a strong infrastructure of roads, of ports, of harbors where you can move your goods around. That's our job as government.
Thank you. Mr. Berkowitz?
I spent a little time commercial fishing in Bristol Bay, three seasons out there. As I joke, I learned three ways of going broke: no fish, no price, no processors. And I learned a lot about commercial fisheries during that time. I've learned a lot when I was in the legislature. And commercial fisheries provide 70,000 jobs in this state, not just the salmon fisheries, which are the more glamorous ones that we know about, but the ground fish, the ground fisheries, the pollock, the CDQ groups. There are tremendous fishing opportunities in this state and will be for a long time as long as we have an active hand in management. And I'm not talking about allocation. I'm talking about making sure that the stocks are healthy, the fishing communities are solvent, and energy prices are low. Because Alaska fisheries are absolutely key to our future. It's a sustainable resource. It's something that is integral to the state's identity. Now, the same can be said for mining, too. And I supported mining where it makes sense. I've supported what has gone on in Red Dog or Pogo, because mining is also critical. And I think it's dangerously naive to think that in this world we can get by without the product of mining. America's too dependent on foreign resources as it is. And Alaska has a great storehouse of some of those strategic resources. And if it's not mined here, it's going to come from another dangerous part of the world. I'd much rather see it come from our shores so we can make money off that resources, provide jobs for our people. So to answer the question, fishing and mining have an important part in my view of what's important for Alaska. But we've got to do it by building the infrastructure that's going to sustain those industries. We've got to do it in a way that makes sure that Alaskans get the jobs that are attached to them and that the state resources benefit the people of the state as well.
Okay, if you'll remain there for this question. Several people have commented on this, so I'm going to try to put this idea together. You've both talked about fiscal plans. You've talked about development sustaining incentives. But nobody has talked about the role of the federal government and money from the federal government in the development and the sustainability of Alaska. As you think of fiscal plans, as you think of the future, what role, if any, do you see monies from the federal government playing? And secondly, what is your goal in terms of a relationship with whatever the current Washington administration happens to be on issues of ANWR and OCS?
Your Honor, that's a compound question, I believe.
Yes, and you can give us a compound answer. Thank you.
All right, well, I think the state has a unique relationship with the federal government. Two-thirds of state land is in federal hands. And we need to make the federal government aware that Alaska wants to go our own way and be in charge of our own decisions. Here we are 50 years after statehood, and we're still trying to stand up and be sovereign. We've got to do a better job at doing that. I don't think we do it by using the bellicose terms that I hear out of some people saying we're going to war with the federal government, we're fighting them, we're in combat. That's ridiculous. We can be Alaskans and Americans at the same time. We can disagree with our government and stand up for the things that we believe in without castigating the federal government and making them into the enemy. There are real enemies out there. There are real enemies in the Middle East, in Afghanistan. There are real enemies across the world. And I think it denigrates the honorable service of people in the military when we use those same terms of combat against our own government. And I wish that would stop. Because there are ways to be tough without using tough words. It requires tough deeds. So I will assure you that I will stand up for what I think is in Alaska's best interest, regardless of who sits in the White House, regardless of which party is in control in Washington, D.C. Because as governor, my job is to protect Alaska. And I believe passionately in this state. I believe that there are 50 states, and each one is allowed to go its own way, forge its own democracy. And the federal government shouldn't tell us how to do things. That's not its job. But we have a relationship with the federal government. And using terms that burn bridges, terms that are designed to inflame rather than enlighten, those aren't the terms that leaders use. And we have got to get past that. It's a question of being a mature, responsible state. Because until we get that, you're going to continue to see the kind of inflammatory rhetoric that exists time and again where nothing ever gets done. Because it's politics simply becomes about who's going to win instead of who's going to lead and who's going to govern. And that's why we haven't been able to get ANWR. That's why OCS has been halted, because we haven't been able to have constructive, rational dialogue with people. And until you dial down the rhetoric, until you make this less about who's going to win and how we're going to solve problems, problems aren't going to get solved. And I will tell you that in any kind of spitting contest between the federal government and the state of Alaska, the federal government's going to win, because it's a lot bigger than we are. So we need to be a lot smarter.
Senator French, same two questions. Federal money in Alaska, and what about ANWR and OCS?
You know, the role of the federal government in Alaska is a fascinating question. And I think let's just take it from a fiscal perspective. We have seen, I believe, over the last 20 years, an unprecedented era of federal support to Alaska, an era which is coming to an end. Ted Stevens is no longer in the United States Senate. Don Young is no longer a powerful member of Congress. That era is behind us, and we have to stand on our own 2 feet. That's why we keep a fair oil tax on the books. That's why we invest in Alaska. This governor vetoed $300 million worth of capital projects this year, a decision that I strongly disagreed with. We have to build Alaska on our own. We have to stand up for ourselves. I am a supporter of opening ANWR. I would open that. I would flip a switch and open ANWR if I could. I spent too many years in the oil industry not to believe that we can safely drill in the 1002 area on the northern edge of ANWR and promote economic development, promote oil development, put more oil in the pipeline, and not harm the creatures that roam the North Slope. That's my personal belief. I'm a supporter of OCS drilling, but not without a strong coastal zone management program in place. I strongly disagreed when that program was gutted many years ago. We tried to forge a compromise this year to put that program back on the books to give some form of local control to the individuals who will be directly impacted by that drilling. People that have lived in Barrow and Point Lay and Point Hope for thousands of years, who depend on the mammals that swim in that ocean for their food security. And until something strong like that is in place that gives them a voice in the development, we should wait, because you cannot clean up oil in the Arctic Ocean. I've seen it done. I was there holding a video camera as a Shell Oil Company employee on a barge in the Beaufort Sea in broken ice condition. And I saw oil put in that water, and it came out under great, great difficulty. They essentially had to jump guys into the water to shovel it out a shovel full at a time. An oil spill in the Arctic is disaster. So go slowly, go carefully, give some local control. But ANWR, flip a switch and let's get going.
All right, please remain there to answer the next set of questions. I'm going to try now to change off of the fiscal and the economic into some of the healthcare issues. There has been established a healthcare commission for the state of Alaska. First, do you support the continuation of that? And secondly, we have been looking, because of all the activity that's been going on in Congress, to the federal government as far as health care or insurance reform is concerned. But what about programs that already exist in Alaska? that in fact could serve perhaps as expertise for the rest of the country. And the suggestion has referred to programs like Alaska Native Health Services, Anchorage Neighborhood Health, the Veterans Services. As governor, what would your plan be to work with health issues for Alaskans, in Alaskans, with Alaskans?
First question, I can't even remember the question, but I know the answer is yes. Because I wrote down yes. And as far as the...
That's the continuation of the Healthcare Commission.
Yes, I'm a big supporter. I voted for it. But how, you know, what do we do right? How about Denali? Kid care is an idea that we should keep promoting. And let's get out to a new subject. How about looking to the, you know, I went to Bethel. I went to the YKHC, the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. That organization is delivering fantastic health care to dozens of small villages through innovative health care systems, through broadband, through telemedicine, trying to keep costs down, trying not to fly a patient from Hooper Bay into Bethel if you can diagnose the problem over the internet through a peer-to-peer system. There are great developments happening there, great developments that close the distance of Alaska, that collapse the costs of bringing patients not only to Bethel but then on to Anchorage if you can solve the problem in place. There are fantastic opportunities in that area. We need to continue to push in that direction. And so that's my quick answer on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Berkowitz?
You know, they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And I was very flattered when the Healthcare Commission legislation was proposed after I'd left the legislature. It looked eerily similar to a bill that I'd proposed just a year or two before. And that bill was, strangely enough, patterned on a lot of the work that had been done here at Commonwealth North. I think the Healthcare Commission is important for us to continue to understand some of the drivers on healthcare costs and the things we need to do differently in the state to provide healthcare to our people. You know, one of the things that's been interesting about the safety net that's sprung up to provide healthcare is neighborhood health clinics all around the state. And these healthcare clinics provide a lot of the basic services that get provided. And we need to do a better job making sure that veterans, for example, can access services at them. We need to do a better job integrating so IHS, Indian Health Service money gets to go through it. And we need to take down some of the bureaucratic barriers that impede people who are the beneficiaries of certain government programs from accessing other government programs. Because when you have those barriers, it generates inefficiencies. And those inefficiencies are costs that ultimately get borne without providing one iota of health care. So we need to take them down. But I also think we need to do a much better job making sure that Alaskans can grow up to become doctors or nurses or other healthcare professionals. We've got a great program in WAMI. It's the beginning medical program that we have in this state. We don't have a medical school. We could have a medical school. We have a fine nursing program. It could be a better nursing program. The cost of providing what they call traveler nurses is exorbitant. And there's good people. I've met many travelers over time, but they come and they go. And those are jobs that Alaskans can and should have. So we can do a lot more to provide basic health care than we have in this state. We need to do it. Briefly on the ability to do telemedicine. Alaskan telemedicine has actually been deployed in the Middle East as part of our military services because we did some of the pioneering work on that here. But we can do so much more. We can do so much more. The amount of broadband infrastructure that's available in the state to deliver those kind of services is huge. And I will point out that we tend to look at those kind of broadband services as being a one-way street. That people in a village can receive treatment from a doctor or a healthcare professional somewhere in Anchorage or in the lower 48, but it works the other way too. You can have healthcare professionals in the village administering treatment to someone in Anchorage or New York or New Delhi. And it's a way for us to be able to have the expertise in state that we need. So there are a lot of things that have to happen. But again, doing nothing is not one of the tangible answers.
Senator French? Oh, you answered that one?
I did.
I'm sorry. My mind is on the next question, which is, okay, That all sounds good from both of you. Now the question becomes, can we talk in Alaska, and do you have the leadership vision to establish and try to work toward health care provision that is not simply another state entitlement program? In other words, is there a role for the state in health care that doesn't simply pay for services?
Well, I think the short answer is public health measures. Public health measures are the way you deliver new ideas and new behaviors and new ways of living to the people who live here without an enormous investment in delivery of specific services to specific individuals. And so again, it goes back to fighting obesity, fighting smoking, making sure you have access to clean water, things like that that promote public health in a general way.
Okay. Mr. Berkowitz?
For example, we had a big, can anyone get closer? I mean, we're getting intimate enough where people had to gather in here, but we had a big tobacco settlement a couple years ago where we were supposed to take all this tobacco settlement money and use it for prevention programs, cessation and prevention programs. Well, all that money got diverted, or not all of it, but a good chunk of it got diverted to general fund and didn't go to the public health purpose it was designed for. That shouldn't happen. I've also, I've got two kids in public school here, and they have PE once, maybe twice a week. That's not good enough. We've got to make sure that our young people learn how to keep their bodies healthy as they're growing up, because those are the kind of things that create healthier people over their lifetime. So there are a lot of small things that we can do in the public health arena that don't necessitate the outlay of public monies. But there's also public monies that should be destined for healthcare that aren't there. We've got huge problems in this state with alcohol and drug abuse, huge. And we don't have enough rehabilitation facilities. We don't have enough inpatient treatment. We've got huge problems in this state with mental health issues, with suicides, with all kinds of problems like that. We're not focused on them. And I just don't think that you need to have a leadership that can only do one thing at a time. I think capable leadership can multitask, can do several things simultaneously. And we've got to have that kind of leadership. That's what Alaskans need. Let me stay.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to ask each of the candidates now if they would like to make a closing statement. All right. 5 minutes closing.
I'm going to be a lot less than that. I just want to say it's been a pleasure to come speak with you. I've seen a lot of people I know here today. And the fundamental case I make for what, and I'm using this, Judge and Your Honor, is why we need change is Alaska just can't continue to do what we've been doing. It's not good enough. It's not good enough. And I don't think that mediocre is Alaska's destiny. I don't think adequate is what we should aim for. I don't think just getting by is good enough for this state. And we need to be a lot more aggressive in terms of developing the self-sufficiency and the independence that lets us live up to the legacy of people who came before us. I think we do a disservice to the history of this state if we think that being average is adequate. I mean, look at what's happened to per capita income in Alaska. We used to be at the top of the list. Now we're in the middle. We can't afford to continue to slide. We used to be a place that people were proud to call home. We need more people to feel that pride still. It used to be something unique to be an Alaskan. I want people to have that swelling when they feel that again. Because this is a unique place. The opportunities here are unlike anything anywhere else in the world. And we are fortunate to be able to call this place home. And we owe each other the responsibility of trying to make this place as good as it can be. And during the course of a campaign, you hear different people come forward, hopefully with different ideas. But I'm still idealistic enough to believe that you can differ on ideas and still agree on the goal. And the goal that should be shared is that Alaska has to do better. Alaska can do better. And I look forward to sitting at the table up here and taking questions as long as you want to throw them at me. And it'll be a pleasure to be your next governor.
(Clears throat)
Thank you. I'm standing here in front of you today because I love public service. I have found that I enjoy the process, I enjoy the debate, I enjoy trying to make the world a better place. I am in the process of having a conversation with you and thousands of other Alaskans about how you want to see the state led for the next 4 years. I will continue to describe a consistent message of renewable energy and education, and I hope it resonates. I hope it resonates here and in Anchorage and throughout the state, and we can move forward together on a positive vision that that produces concrete results. I told you at the beginning to please judge me based on my ability so far, what you've seen from me so far in my time here in Alaska, to bring my ideas down to earth and make them real. That's the test I ask that you apply. Thanks so much for being here. I do look forward to your questions. I love the dialogue, and I appreciate your time and attention.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to a Democratic gubernatorial debate between Senator Hollis French and Ethan Berkowitz on Addressing Alaskans. In the second half of the program, retired judge and moderator Karen Hunt posed questions to the candidates submitted by audience members. Hosted by Commonwealth North in the ballroom of the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage, the debate between Senator Hollis French and Ethan Berkowitz was recorded on Thursday, August 5th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.